Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. This is Carl Shinneman. I'm the Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov. And, of course, here at ESI Bytes, we try to bring national speakers together to talk about electronic discovery issues at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and hopefully at a time when you're most interested in the topic, which is whenever you download it and want to listen to it. Today we've got two of my friends on this show, and I think it's a real interesting show. We're going to talk about bankruptcy and the electronic discovery process. The speakers we have today are Jeffrey Ritter and Bob Bernstein. Jeffrey Ritter is a recognized globally as one of the most influential voices at the intersection of law and technology. He's a pioneer in shaping the legal rules for cyberspace and addressing the value of digital information as property, whether in the court boardroom, the courtroom, the legislature, or a network operations center. Through his company, Water's Edge, Jeffrey delivers training, assessment, and strategic design services that enable companies to build trusted information systems. Water's Edge also publishes the Castle Quest Discovery Library, which is a growing library of functional, authoritative books, maps, and practice tools for managing digital information with legal value. In electronic discovery, Jeffrey has been a passionate advocate for developing the rules of digital information as evidence, beginning with the first paper submitted in 1995 to the U.S. Judicial Conference from his ABA committee. He serves on the Georgetown Law School eDiscovery Institute Advisory Board, is a member of the faculty for the 2009 eDiscovery Academy, and authored the groundbreaking book, Examining Law Firm Competency, Evaluating the Electronic Discovery Capabilities of Outside Law Firms, which is a book of anyone in the eDiscovery field everyone knows about because it was so widely promoted through BNA. Through Water's Edge, Jeffrey trains law firms, lawyers, and corporate enterprise teams on managing electronic information as evidence. And I met Jeffrey years before he started Water's Edge when he was a partner at K&L Gates. We both spoke at an eDiscovery conference, and he did a really wonderful job, and I'm thrilled to have him on a program with me. Bob Bernstein and I go back a ways. Bob is a partner at the Bernstein Law Firm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He's a managing partner, and he represents businesses of all sizes and types in many areas of their operation, including representation and reorganization proceedings. He has extensive experience in credit recovery matters, including collection, secured transaction, and mortgage foreclosure. He's published a book, Get Paid, a guide to getting paid faster and what to do if you don't, which you can find on Amazon.com or GetPaidSystem.com. Bob has served as both president and treasurer of the Commercial Law League of America, North America's oldest creditor rights organization. He's president of the American Board of Certification, the country's only bankruptcy and creditor rights certifying organization. He works on a number of committees on the Allegheny County Bar Association. He's been past president of and chairman of the Bankruptcy Commercial Law Section, the Technology Utilization Committee, which is where I first got to meet Bob because we worked on that committee, and he's the founder of the Lease Enforcement Attorney Network, LEAN. He's been named the Pennsylvania Super Lawyer in 2004 through 2008. I don't think 2009 hasn't come out yet. In the area of bankruptcy and workout by Philadelphia Magazine. He was also named as one of the 2009 best lawyers in America by his peers in the field of bankruptcy. Thrilled to have both of you on this program.
So, great to be here, Carl.
Okay, well,
absolutely.
Let's start off. First of all, I'd like to ask both of you, first Jeffrey and then Bob, how did you first get into electronic discovery?
Well, in my case, it was a matter of looking at the problems our clients were facing. We had information security executives that were turning to our law firm for compliance issues around privacy and data security guidance, and they began hearing about e-discovery and said that they needed some help on that. So I came at it from a non-litigation perspective, but way back when, in the early 1990s, as I was chairing the ABA Committee on Cyberspace Law, we had litigators come to us back then, even before the Internet, to say they were concerned about digital information as evidence, and would I help them write a paper that they thought should should be submitted to the judicial conference on the issues. And so we, had a working group organized, and they did that. And so from the, for me, for nearly 15 years, we've recognized that there were going to be questions about whether digital information could be accepted as evidence for the truth. And only recently did they really begin to accelerate.
And Bob, how did you get involved? You get extra points, of course, for every time you mention my name in this answer.
Well, way back before Carl Shinneman, and I don't know if this is directly related to eDiscovery, but I have one copy left of a magazine called Word Processing World Magazine from September of 1978, which, Carl, I think that's before you were born. where I was featured in an article about our new Digital Equipment Corporation PDP-8E computer. Now, most people who hear this won't even know what that was, but it was our firm's first foray into automation and into technology, and it got me interested in the process of computerization and technology and data. And that led me on a trail which, as you mentioned, through the things like the Technology Utilization Committee at the Allegheny County Bar, where we were thinking about different ways that that lawyers use technology and can. Our firm has always been, I think, at the cutting edge of technology in law firms. And I never thought, as opposed to Jeffrey, I didn't think about it I didn't start thinking about e-discovery until it was thrust on me in a significant bankruptcy case. And then I brought my technology side of my brain to bear on the case to figure out how to deal with and manage this this mountain of data.
Okay. Yeah, 1978, I led the Englewood, New Jersey Little League in batting. Okay, so that was my nothing related to eDiscovery. All right. Well,
I think you were drafted by the junior high school, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Jeffrey, I mentioned Bob's book, but you just wrote a book on this subject related to bankruptcy law and eDiscovery called Discovering the Digital Record, the Questions for Examination. First, before I forget, since I mentioned how to find Bob's book, how would you find this book?
Well, the book is part of our publication line, and all of them are available as part of our Castle Quest Discovery Library. And that can be available at www.cqdiscovery.com.
And that web link will be on the ESI Bytes website. So anyway, this book focuses on how debtor counsel can develop effective e-discovery strategies and alerts bank and creditor counsel what they might expect. Tell us why you decided to write this book.
Well, over the last 6 months, we've had increasing calls here at Water's Edge to be training solo practitioners, people that most often represent the little guy, whether it's in auto fraud cases, bankruptcies and foreclosures, sometimes mortgage loan considerations. The real need is for the solo lawyers to understand these issues and be able to address them competently, but in a cost-effective fashion. The book was written in response to that appetite. We found that training is good, but we can only train 20 or 30 people at a time. It's very time-intensive. And the book is a way of putting our practice tools and our learning method in front of more lawyers so they can go through it at their own leisure. But the book's helpful to both sides. We're not just working for one side of the case. And as well as we're training solo practitioners on how to deal with these questions, by publishing them in the open forum, we're letting those that may be asked to the questions, primarily financial services firms and creditors counsel, to know what they should expect from a well-trained lawyer who is asking the right questions about the validity of their electronic records.
We've done two podcasts in this area that are right on point with that. And if you get inquiries in that area, Sharon Nelson and John Simic, you probably know because they're out in your area and out in Virginia, involved with the ABA, did something on how to do e-discovery in small cases from a forensic and technology side. And then Judge Facciola, also out in your area, and Tom French did something on why all lawyers need to understand this ethically.
We are the Silicon Valley of e-discovery here in Virginia and Maryland.
All right. Well, Bob, we're both from Pittsburgh, so I'm going to ask you a question. We have the inferiority complex. We come up with a lot of good ideas on e-discovery here. So
you have a good hockey team.
That's true. As a bankruptcy attorney, where does e-discovery impact bankruptcy the most?
Well, a frequent topic in bankruptcy cases is the investigation of fraud of one kind or another. Whether it's the perhaps benign fraudulent transfer or something a little more nefarious, bankruptcy is generally about trying to figure out what happened. It's almost like doing an autopsy and trying to figure out what happened to this enterprise or what happened to this asset pool. And a lot of the time, the records are either non-existent or in disarray. So you're coming at it after the fact, and you're coming at it with a set of records that are not very good. And so you have to try and figure out how to reconstruct things. And I think that's why I see it being useful in bankruptcy so much more frequently.
Okay. And then, Jeffrey, in the context of the book, you came up with a couple of areas where you saw some issues coming up. You want to expand on them?
Well, sure, absolutely. You know, actually, in some sense, I've almost grown outraged at some of the horror stories that plaintiff and debtor counsel are sharing with me about the quality of records that are presented. Time and time again, we're seeing that the financial institutions believe that in many instances, not all, but in many, they can come to court and it's almost a pro forma process to obtain their default judgment or their waiver of stay so they can execute on the mortgage and sell the house. And in fact, when the judge is trained often by the counsel to ask the right questions that simply test whether the paper records being presented in front of them are worth the paper they're printed on, we find the answers falling short. In fact, one of the most important cases in dealing with authenticity of records arose in bankruptcy where, all people, American Express was attempting to get relief on a credit card debt that was owed. And the court rejected their claim, arguing that they had failed to properly authenticate their own computer records as the substantiating evidence of the amount of the debt. There have been several other cases where we've been brought in to coach counsel on how to get to the right information. Another example is when a house is in foreclosure, the creditor will add on to the claim and the relief for stay motion the attorney's fees that are involved. Well, we're increasingly seeing that number shift around, and there is a reason to believe that perhaps there's some kickbacks going on in which the dollar amount of the attorney's fees may be covering up other payments. By asking the attorneys to provide the electronically stored information that shows and documents the actual time on the case, the amount of the engagement, how they invoiced for the case, we're putting them in the uncomfortable position of actually being required to maintain trusted billing records. Probably, though, the most the most troublesome issue that's beginning to arise are creditors that appear in court and are not actually able to prove that they own the promissory note and have the true right to enforce the obligation against the debtor who owns the home. The courts, just in the last 2 weeks, we've seen several new cases come out where the creditor is unable to prove they are the real party in interest, and therefore the court is denying their claim for relief from the automatic stay. What's happened is, as there was such a flurry and continuation of momentum in initiating mortgages and the secondary market matured, the companies built these extravagant electronic systems for transferring control of the promissory notes and ownership and syndicating them into securitizations. And they never actually thought someone would ask, do you have the real note and can you prove that you're the lawful owner? As a matter of fact, they often cannot. And this is proving to be one of the most surprising and disturbing aspects of this entire financial crisis, is that many of the institutions that are claiming they are owed money are unable to prove that they have that right to stand in the court.
You know, if I can just jump in, Jeffrey, that is a very interesting situation with the mortgages and the idea that people are now putting these creditors to the test. I think that for so long it was kind of like our monetary system. You know, it just built on faith. Everybody assumed that these creditors had all their ducks in a row. And now, for whatever political reasons or economic reasons, people are starting to push back on that, and it's causing some consternation throughout the system.
Max Gardner is a nationally recognized bankruptcy lawyer for consumers, and when Max and I were on a panel in Chicago a couple weeks ago, he came up with the metaphor, so I have to give him credit for it. But he said, every promissory note is just like an airplane. It has a black box that in that black box, the computers record without any human engagement where the note is, where it was sent, who has control over the note, and therefore who has the right to enforce the note. We have to shape e-discovery in Max's mind and in mine so that the lawyers and the courts never even get to the question of enforcement until we demand that the creditor shows up with a black box that demonstrates their true ownership of the obligation, their true right of enforcement, and that they are the real party in interest. And guess what? Many of them cannot. Training the lawyers to make those demands upon the creditors, we're actually advancing a very important rule of law, which is that the attorney has an obligation as the officer of the court to assure that the information being presented is, in fact, admissible and relevant and reliable. As Max and I were doing this panel, he brought everyone's attention to an affidavit that had been filed in a recent case in which the name of the affiant, who was a purported representative of the creditor, had been stamped with a hand stamp on the affidavit. And he said to the audience with some amusement, you can generally assume that an affidavit that has anything hand stamped on it probably is suspect.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. To add one last point into that, and then we'll move into sort of some of the technical areas of the bankruptcy. I think there were close to a million jobs lost in the mortgage field in 2007, 2008. It was when the economy just started imploding. So a lot of those black boxes sort of vaporized anyway with the people that were involved in the loans.
Sure.
It's a very complicated situation.
So it goes back to the issue, though, that you mentioned at the outset about ethics. We're seeing that the lawyers on both sides are remarkably unfamiliar with the technology. They're unfamiliar with digital records, if not intimidated by them. And they continue to persist in this faith-based reasoning that anything printed out from a computer is just as good as the original. And unfortunately, that is not the right presumption in the 21st century for us.
Well, the reason I wanted to do this podcast was I was talking to a couple of bankruptcy lawyers out of the state. And I think I was talking to one in Indianapolis who knows a bit about e-discovery, but then said you hadn't really gotten a chance to use it in bankruptcy because most clients thought it was too expensive. And I know there are ways to do this more efficiently, and that's why I brought Bob in here, and he's had some experience in this area. So let's talk about is it first of all is it rare that bankruptcy filings have electronic discovery issues in it, or is the rarity caused by the fact that most practitioners don't think about it? If you both want to comment on that, first Jeffrey, then Bob.
I think there is a stone wall of denial. When we train lawyers, many of them have very strong reactions to the training. And this is not meant to be biased against anyone in particular, but it is an observation that if we're training a group of 50 and there's a lawyer that is, say, my age, in his mid-50s, he's as likely to come up to the class and say, I'd rather retire now than learn this stuff. We've even had a young lawyer in their first few years of practice come up to me and berate me on the break, saying, the reason I went to law school was so I didn't need to know this computer stuff. So I think that there's a real resistance in the profession to actually doing the right thing in participating in the legal process in a digital world. At the same time, law firms have said that they don't want our training courses because if I only trained 20 people in the firm and they have 300 litigators, that means they have 280 that are not trained and they potentially have a risk area. But, you know, that kind of thinking is just not advancing efficiency.
We had a good,
exploiting inefficiency.
A good podcast with on e-scoping, and the panelists said that they were brought in to a project after a litigator had started going in the wrong direction at their firm, and they turned it around. And that's, accessing the right resources in a firm, you pointed out a real problem in e-discovery.
But in a bankruptcy case, the likelihood is more often than not that because of the inherent skills needed to navigate the different rules and to understand the law, you're seeing small firms and solo practitioners who are coming at it from a very different perspective.
Bob, what's your take on this?
Well, bankruptcy generally is a volume practice, especially in the consumer world. And I think generally you can imagine that lawyers get a flat fee, a fixed fee for handling the debtor side of a bankruptcy case. And so they're looking to move them through the system as quickly and efficiently as they can within the bounds of their legal and ethical duties. So I don't think they're looking for the nuances. Now, that said, lawyers, as Jeffrey said, should recognize when there is an issue and at least consider it and decide whether to do something about it. And I think that by and large, lawyers today are not looking at those things in the bankruptcy court. You know, it's funny the story you told about the mid-50s lawyer who would rather retire. I have a partner, Chuck Bobinas, who 10 years ago didn't turn his computer on. It sat on his desk, and it was more of a paperweight. Chuck has really come on so strong in this area, and actually there's an article on our website that Chuck wrote called Why Bankruptcy Practitioners Should Care About E-Discovery that talks about many of these issues. Chuck is our senior litigator, and so he's seen these things firsthand. I think the answer specifically to the question why we're not seeing them as much in bankruptcy, first of all, there are relatively few cases that can support even an efficient e-discovery process in bankruptcy because of the cost. And two, they're simply, by volume, there are so few bankruptcy cases that need to even consider discovery at all, let alone the e-discovery.
Well, I think one of the things we're discovering from our side, so to speak, of this is that oftentimes the consumer is in the awkward position of challenging a business practice by a creditor that may be unsavory, may be illegal, but doesn't have the resources to truly conduct the investigation from an e-discovery perspective. Yet we're finding that just by training the lawyers to ask the right questions without necessarily having a high level of skill in technical knowledge, they can hold the cost down because the right questions confront adversary party with the obvious truth that they're going to have to disclose electronically stored information that's uncomfortable. And then they suddenly begin looking at this in a different way. Our goal, in fact, as we train lawyers, is they should be able to start a deposition and within 7 minutes have opposing counsel call for a recess in order to discuss settlement. And I'll give you a good example of that. Yesterday we had a lawyer that we coach contact us whose client was in bankruptcy and who had tried to consider alternative options to the sale of the home and was told by the creditor's representative time and time again, no, we won't do anything like that. We won't consider lump sum settlement. We won't consider deferral. All we want to do is to have you pay your payments or we'll sell the house. Well, it turns out that violates, as I'm told by this lawyer, HUD guidelines on HUD financed loans. And so we put together a structured deposition that simply puts a representative of the creditor under oath and begins asking how their software of their call center is operated and how does the customer service representative get cued by the screen displays as to what script to follow based on the options available. And we know that all of that is embedded in code and scripts that are used by the CSRs to maintain quality assurance. Just by that simple five-page structured questionnaire, we're able to confront the issue and clearly bring out onto the table either they're going to have the call records that demonstrate that the debtor is not telling the truth, or they're going to be very uncomfortable because they know that we'll keep asking the questions to find inside the computer the black box on how they structure their collection activities.
Well, this is all fascinating. There are of course other areas in bankruptcy that involve e-discovery when you're looking for fraud. And Bob, what are you, but as you pointed out, not many cases can support an e-discovery initiative. Bankruptcy, of course, is cost sensitive, more so than most cases by definition. So thinking about those cases, how do you use electronic discovery tools in a bankruptcy case?
Well, the sort of stories that Jeffrey's talking about are interesting and sometimes comical and cute. And to the consumer who is faced with that situation, it is a very important case. So I don't mean to make light of that at all. Most of the work I do are on the business cases, and I've seen the benefits of serious e-discovery in some of these more complicated, larger dollar cases. Just a couple of quick examples, and they're really two different kinds of e-discovery. One was a very large, I represented the trustee of a failed law firm, and we picked up initially before there was any real discovery from adverse parties, we picked up almost 8 million pages of documents from the computers of the failed firm. And just the idea of having to manage those documents and figure out what was in them was a daunting task for what was at that time a 10-lawyer firm. Our firm was a 10-lawyer firm. The trustee's firm, who was co-counsel, was about the same size. And of course, Carl, in your prior life, you knew a lot about how to staff cases and what you do when faced with something like that. So the first thing we did was set up a coding operation and hired a bunch of temporary lawyers, and they started reading documents. At the same time, we had to have a mechanism to keep those documents. So we went outside to a service firm who could load up, scan those all the documents, because much of it came in electronic form, so it didn't necessarily have to be scanned per se, but they had to load it up in a way that was usable. The coding people started to work and worked for a few months, and it just I said, well, there has to be a better way, because it will take us years and millions of dollars to get through these documents. It was a large potential recovery. The damages were in the $60 million range, so it justified some expense, but it wasn't going to justify millions of dollars. That's when we went to one of the systems out there that is able to apply artificial intelligence to the process, to apply linguistic analysis to the process, and help us find information in documents without having to read each one of them. So that was my first experience with large-scale e-discovery, so to speak. We did, in that case, and the case is over at this point, I can actually mention it was Arter and Haddon, which was a firm out of Cleveland that that imploded. We ended up being able to manage this data and see what was in there and use it in a way that ultimately allowed us to settle the case in a very nice way for the trustee. Move a little more recently in time, working on a case presently where we have actually had to do what most people think of as really discovery, and that is the forensic analysis, reconstruction, looking at the metadata, figuring out the versions of documents and the timing of the versions and who had them and when they were circulated, because those issues are material to the case. This is a breach of fiduciary duty case against officers and directors, and some of these documents, which in our view were actually attempted to be deep-sixed, were recovered in the e-discovery process. Now, that has been another major case. That one involves several million dollars. But as we got closer in time, more recent, we've been able to learn more about the tools and been able to do it much more efficiently. Going through millions of documents is a lot easier today than it was 5 years ago, and certainly 10 years ago.
Yeah, there's two dimensions of this I want to respond to, Bob.
Actually,
yeah,
I don't want to lose one point here, because
sure.
This is I reached the same conclusion, which is why I focus on technology and not staffing. I had sold my company when you were staffing that project.
Right. You abandoned
planned my exit. but the you know, what you learned, because you didn't have big budgets, was you could use technology to find information quicker, maybe not perfectly, but quicker and for less money than actually physically going through these documents. That's sort of what your lesson learned was on this, right?
Absolutely. There was an actual example when the outsource firm was showing us this technology. My partner, Chuck, had literally looked through tens of thousands of documents himself, and he came up with a couple of documents that were the smoking guns. In the demonstration project, we loaded up hundreds of thousands of documents into this system, and within a few hours after talking to us about the issues in the case, the company was able to come up with a target list of documents, a couple of dozen documents that included exactly those smoking gun documents that Chuck had ferreted out.
That's
very impressive.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
So not having a lot of money forced you to try to be efficient, and it's an interesting lesson. I mean, I almost non-bankruptcy lawyers would probably get some benefit out of this, hearing that, but sometimes they have more resources to burn and they're more risk-averse. So
I think, though, that the judges are pushing back a little bit. We have to be cautious about how you structure this. The traditional method of discovery that we continue to see in the 21st century is a shotgun any and all approach, you know, where the production requests are any and all policies, procedures, templates, design models, et cetera, regarding X and Y, or any and all documents, communications, et cetera. When we begin to apply that shotgun seek all approach in the electronic digital information world, you really are asking for too much. And the judges, aware of the cost sensitivities, aware of cost burdens, are really looking to counsel in these cases to be very focused on what they are asking for. And so, at least in our world, we're coaching the lawyers that they have to change their method of initiating discovery. And I think what's true in bankruptcy, a little less than some other civil litigation, is we really do know with a greater sense of precision the kinds of records we're looking for to prove the fraud or to prove the breach of fiduciary duty. And by being very clear about those records, we can then be very aggressive in demanding and obtaining the additional information around those records that helps tell the who, what, when, and where story. So, for example, if you're looking at breach of fiduciary duty in various drafts of documents, you know, asking for the specific data that demonstrates each version of that document, each access record to that document, each email to which it was attached, the judges get that, and they're going to sustain and support discovery that gets to that additional data. But if it's done on an any and all approach, judges are beginning to push back that those discovery requests are not sufficiently precise as to support a motion to compel. And it's just an interesting balancing.
Yeah, we did some podcasts with Judge Grimm and Judge Facciola in the last few weeks, and they both made very cogent arguments on rethinking discovery and trying to use more tools, more sampling, more statistics, not killing our young lawyers.
Well, there's a balance there to be said, though, because you know all of the legal system is built on the bias that it is the oral testimony of a human being in direct eye contact with the finders of fact, be it a judge or a jury, that is the best source of the truth. And we're rapidly shifting to a world in where those black boxes are going to be viewed as very reliable, and particularly a contradicting oral testimony. And it's important that in rethinking discovery, we don't overlook the importance of the computer as a witness.
Yeah, that's true. Now, Bob, going back to sort of the commercial cases, who typically pays for the review of ESI?
Well, you know, bankruptcy is kind of a strange animal because in many situations, it's the assets of the debtor that are paying for all of the expense. In a Chapter 11 case, you have the debtor in possession operating with its professionals who are paid by the debtor in possession. You have the Committee of Unsecured Creditors operating with its professionals who are paid by the debtor in possession. You may have a trustee who's paid out of the assets. There are other parties that have to stand on their own, secured creditors who pay their own way, but often have their obligation tailored so that in the end they get their attorney's fees from and expenses from the debtor. So it's all coming out of the same pot, which makes for interesting positioning. It's a zero-sum game generally because there's a limited pot, and if one party is eating up a lot of expense, others will be pushing back on that. The question of who generally pays for it, in my experience, it's been someone who is investigating a wrong, a fraud, or another wrong, and that is usually a trustee or a creditor that has a big claim who is trying to push the case along. And it often happens that there is not enough money in the case to pay for that, so somebody is fronting it and essentially handling it on a contingent fee or contingent expense basis.
And when you made the decision to switch from manual review to sort of pulling concepts out using your search tools, you did come up with sort of an ROI, you know, it could cost this if I do it this way versus I could get through this a lot less with a lot less money. Do you want to share that? Or?
Well, in that case, there was a fund, there was a fairly large fund that the trustee had out of which he could pay expenses. And we were fortunate that Judge Baxter over in Cleveland was willing to allow us to have interim compensation in this Chapter 7 case, which is pretty unusual. But we still had to make the analysis, and just using round numbers, we thought that at the pace we were going with the document review, that the physical review, that we would have spent about $2.5 million and 3 years. Now, we could have spent more money and shortened the time, but at about $2.5 million and 3 years to get through all of these documents before we had any productions from the adversaries. So that just seemed to be daunting to us. We ended up with a system that allowed us to spend about $600,000 and get it done in 6 months.
Good. Okay. Now let's talk about the process here. When do you start the e-discovery process in bankruptcy?
Well, I'm learning that you start it as soon as you have a suspicion, as soon as there's a target. Bankruptcy has the opportunity, and I haven't used it this way yet, but bankruptcy has the opportunity for discovery which does not relate to a specific adversary proceeding. Bankruptcy has Rule 2004, which allows an examination examination of any person concerning the acts, assets, liabilities, etc. of the debtor. I haven't used it through 2004 yet. I've only used it where there is a distinct adversary proceeding, a distinct lawsuit. But I think, and I know Jeffrey can comment on this through his experience, as soon as you know there's a target, you really have to do something, particularly because the people on the other side, if they are not aware of their obligations, their litigation hold obligations, et cetera, things can disappear, and that can hurt your effort. And if they are aware, there are ways that they're figuring out how to protect themselves against you already. So the earlier you strike, the better.
Yeah, I think it's very important what Bob just said in light of the remarks I made earlier about, you know, the learning curve that the profession still has. We actually do something very unusual in the tools that we give lawyers. We actually deliver them forms for the interrogatories and requests for production and deposition notices that are annotated with the case law that actually substantiates why they are asking for something. In effect, and often in discovery, the first response of many lawyers is, oh, that's that computer stuff that I don't want to deal with, so I'll just deny. But when you actually see annotated on the request for production or the preservation instructions letter, the case law that you confront that makes this request per se part of your legal duty, we put the motion to compel in front of them. It changes the awareness of the need and hopefully changes the seriousness with which they take that first step.
So, Bob, you talked about putting the other side on notice before records disappear, before people leave. I mean, that happens in bankruptcy and commercial cases all the time. And you also mentioned there are different rules in bankruptcy that pertain to bankruptcy. Do you have a meet and confer like in federal court litigation? Is it collaborative or is it an adversarial process?
Bankruptcy is generally a collaborative process, although that obviously breaks down here and there. And Rule 26 applies, of course, different districts and different judges handle it differently. And I can tell you from experience that in complex situations, if the judge is not enforcing Rule 26, you really ought to ask him or her to, because it's come back to bite us in some situations where we had that informal meet and confer, but it wasn't structured as well as it should have, and there were some things that fell through the cracks. So I think in a case where e-discovery is justified, where there is a complex situation, it would help to make sure that the judge invokes that.
Okay. Jeffrey, if we're looking at this area generally, and you've talked about some of the materials you have, but you've also written about sort of assessing competency in this area. You know, some of the people listening to this might not have had a lot of experience with e-discovery. How do you find vendors if you don't have much experience in this field?
With a high degree of risk. Vendors are very responsive to urgent crisis and reactive buying. They sell fear, they sell doubt, and there's very few vendors that are willing to develop a structured relationship, particularly with solo practitioners. We are beginning to see, though, as the market opens up here, integrated solutions where a single hardware platform, like a one computer, a desktop computer, has on it the software and the interrogation toolkits that it will allow a lawyer to go out and work with their client to conduct the discovery. You know, e-discovery goes both ways, and as the person that's speaking here from the consumer side, it's important to remember that even the consumer can be exposed to the burden of e-discovery. Right now, I think what we're beginning to see are tools emerge that allow the solo practitioner to have in front of them not only the technical capability, but also the intellectual knowledge tools they need to do the job well. But what they should be looking for are vendors that are able to go in and act with a high degree of competency on the chain of custody. You know, if I had my top three list issues that often get overlooked in selecting a vendor, first of all, it's does the vendor have the ability to create and maintain a chain of custody from the point of collection on a target system to the point of presentation as evidence? Oftentimes, vendors are good at collecting, but the controls around the integrity of the data are weak. Second is, can the vendor provide to you a security audit? A friend of mine does very sophisticated penetration testing, which is where you test a computer system to see whether it has been compromised by a hostile actor. And this was done out on the West Coast. They did three different audits of e-discovery service vendors. In all three instances, the service vendor had been compromised with a worm software package, which is a really bad thing, that actually read data that the vendor was storing on their system. And every time someone at the vendor communicated with the internet, then the worm would duplicate the corporate data that was on the server and send it to a location over in Asia. So corporate intelligence bad actors are actually targeting the e-discovery process and the service vendors. So it's real important to have a security audit. The third thing is, do they have someone prepared to testify about their process? It's essential to the chain of custody that someone be able to actually describe what they have done, that they have experience doing so, and that your case will not rest upon the happenstance of someone who just left Geeks on Call and is now working for the vendor that doesn't really know the process.
And I would point people to the podcast that Sharon Nelson, John Simic did on small case e-discovery, you know, everyday cases. I think they give some good practical tips.
Yeah, and I think what Jeffrey said is very important, Carl, because there are lots of situations where the e-discovery process results in settlement or workout, but sooner or later you may actually have to use this stuff in court.
Yeah. Well, just a couple questions left here. One sort of a cleanup question. Going back into the housing mess here, Jeffrey, you had pointed out lots of strategies that the foreclosee could use to defend themselves and stay in their house. But what are some of the critical strategies banks and creditors can adopt to better assure the admissibility of their records?
Well, any corporate institution that requires on their records as a basis of collection of financial transactions has to anticipate the world and the rules have now changed. The first step is to conduct an assessment, an honest, rigorous assessment of the quality of your records management programs. And records management today means more than the paper documents that are in cardboard boxes in a warehouse. Those are the ones that Bob's partner was familiar with in doing 10,000 document reviews. Instead, it's a combination of records management, IT architecture, as well as information security. With that assessment, the goal is to then design a management process that takes account that the records under management may be needed as evidence, and therefore they have to be capable of meeting the legal standards, but also meeting the technical standards. We teach that the information security manager probably knows more about electronic information as evidence than the lawyer, because the values of information security are the same values of authenticity in the courtroom. And so getting those full teams engaged and recognizing that from the first moment a record is created, it could be served as evidence for the truth, I think those are the steps: assess, design, and then implement with a appropriate attention to measuring the results and always getting better. That kind of a business approach is one that's embraced by ISO standards, the International Organization for Standardization, that touch on records management, IT management, information security, and we encourage companies to look at those standards as a foundation for designing improved practices that really deliver to them a defensible standard of care.
And I would also suggest people, if they're interested in the record management area, we did a podcast with Carol Chotsky, who's a former president of ARMA and very established author in the area on some strategies in that area. Sort of last question here. Since most bankruptcy lawyers don't have a depth of experience in electronic discovery, any best tip at the end here, Bob, based on your practical experience, Jeffrey, from your book, any tips for the unwary?
Bob, I'll let you go first.
I think that people just have to realize that this is a part of the practice. It's something they have to know. And if they are not looking at the issues or don't understand the issues, they got to get educated.
Education is important. And it is, as we've said more than once today, an issue of competence and ethical duty. The courts have made clear that the lawyers have an obligation to understand the information and the evidence, and that obligation extends to digital media. Again, under the leadership of Judge Grimm, the Maryland Federal District Court has a suggested protocol that actually lays out in rather rigorous detail what the court expects any lawyer to understand about the information systems and the records. There's a real collision between that comprehensiveness and the cost efficiency that bankruptcy tends to demand as a legal practice. But as an ethical matter, there's no question that it's a cost that is required to be invested in order to be competent.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you for helping out on the show here. And I'd like to let all the listeners know that for a full list of podcasts, you can visit www.esibytes.com. You can use our scroll bar on the right to find podcasts by speakers or by topic within the EDRM model. And also, as we always say here, you should visit ESIBytes to learn about eDiscovery concepts before eDiscovery or ESI bites you back. Thanks again, and have a nice day.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you.